So we're going to open up those packets now, the ones that have Exodus 14, and we're going to focus specifically in on the Red Sea crossing. And I want to begin helping us think through how we're going to actually begin interpreting this part of Scripture, this passage of Scripture. And so we're going to go through this five-step process of understanding the text in the original context to the original audience to our getting all the way to our context today. But we're going to begin in the first step. We're going to begin by reading the story. It's quite a long passage. In the past, we've done a much shorter passage, but we're going to read this whole, it's two pages, read the whole story, and as we go, we're going to be making observations. We don't want to ask at this point, what does it mean? We don't want to ask, what does it mean? We want to be like crime scene investigators that come to the scene of the crime, and they see a dead body on the ground. They don't come and see the dead body and say, ah, this was murder. Someone clearly hated this guy and killed him. They look at the evidence. They say, what do we see? A dead body on the ground. Bullet holes in this dead body. They don't say, ah, therefore someone murdered him. Oh, bullet holes. Look, we see shell casings on the ground. Ah, we see, oh, hey, there's something weird. There's a weird mark over here on the stair. That's interesting. Oh, it looks like there is some bottles of alcohol laying out. Okay, so they're taking note of everything they see, meticulously looking, almost like a Sherlock Holmes, looking at all the evidence, trying to piece together what took place here. So in the first step, we're just going to think about who are the characters, what is the story, when did this happen, where did it take place? So as we're reading, we're looking for certain things. We're looking for observations of the text. And there are a couple things we want to observe. For example, repeated words. We want to think about words that are used over and over again. Like in John 15, Jesus says, abide in me and I in you, and you'll bear much fruit. For whoever abides in me, he will bear much fruit. You see the word abide. Abide, being repeated. And when words are repeated, it's often because a theme is forming. There's something important being said. Or often in John's gospel, he uses the word world to say, for God so loved the world. And he says, I've taken you out of the world. You're not of this world, but I've taken you out of the world. And so you see, as these words are repeated over and over, there's a theme coming about. So you can underline or circle repeated words. Think about the main characters. What is God doing in the story? And what are his people doing? And is there a shift in the story? Is there a pivot in the story? What I mean by that is like in the story of Paul. You see, Paul, before he came to Christ, was a persecutor of the church, ravaging the church, trying to kill the church, trying to overcome the church. And then this road to Damascus experience happens. And that's the shift. That's the shift in Paul's life. It changes his life radically. This experience with the living God on the road to Damascus. Is there some shift in this story that takes place? Someplace we see the tides turning. So we're going to open up that packet. We're going to read through the story. And we're going to ponder it together. Would you like me to read it first for us? And then we can, then you guys can spend some time reading it, making observations, and then we'll get into it. Okay, this is Exodus 14. Exodus 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, tell the people of Israel to turn back and encamp in front of Pi-Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, in front of Baal Zephon. Don't worry about names. What I've heard is, if you don't understand the Hebrew name, just say it confidently and quickly, and people will think they know what they're talking about. You shall encamp facing it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the people of Israel, they are wandering in the land. The wilderness has shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and I will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and his host, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. And they did so. When the king of Egypt was told that the people had fled, the mind of Pharaoh and his servants was changed toward the people. And they said, What is this we have done, that we have let Israel go from serving us? So he made ready his chariots and took his army with him, and took 600 chosen chariots and all the other chariots of Egypt with officers over all of them. And the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the people of Israel while the people of Israel were going out defiantly. Then the Egyptians pursued them, all Pharaoh's horses and chariots and his horsemen and his army, and overtook them and camped at the sea by Pi-Hahiroth in front of Baal Zephon. When Pharaoh drew near, the people of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. And they feared greatly, and the people of Israel cried out to the Lord. They said to Moses, "It is because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away in the wilderness to die in the wilderness? What have you done to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Is not this what we said to you in Egypt? Leave us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness." And Moses said to the people, "Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will work for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord will fight for you, and you have only to be silent." The Lord said to Moses, "Why do you cry to me? Tell the people of Israel to go forward." He's talking to Moses. "Lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea to divide it, that the people of Israel may go through the sea on dry ground. And I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, so that they shall go in after them. And I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his host, his chariots and his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh, his chariots and his horsemen." Then the angel of God, who was going before the host of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from before them and stood behind them, coming between the host of Egypt and the host of Israel. And there was the cloud and the darkness, and it lit up the night without one coming near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord drove back the sea by the strong east wind all night and made the sea dry land. And when the waters were divided, and the people of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the waters being a wall to them on their right and on their left, the Egyptians pursued them, went in after them into the midst of the sea, all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And in the morning watch, the Lord in the pillar of fire and cloud looked down on the Egyptian forces and threw the Egyptian forces into a panic, clogging their chariot wheels so that they drove heavily. And the Egyptians said, "Let us flee before Israel, for the Lord fights for them against the Egyptians." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, that the waters may come back upon the Egyptians, upon the chariots, and upon their horsemen." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal course when the morning appeared. And the Egyptians fled into it. And as the Egyptians fled into it, the Lord threw the Egyptians into the midst of the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the hosts of the Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters being to them a wall on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. Yes. So the people feared the Lord. They believed in the Lord and in his servant Moses. So I'm going to give you about 5-10 minutes now to read this passage, make notes, circle words that are repeated, think about who the key characters are, think about what the climax is, what's happening in the story. Think about retelling the story. And I'm going to give you about 5 minutes now. Anyone have questions on what I'm looking for there? No? Okay, let's spend about 5 minutes now just in the text. And you'll see on the next page after that, I actually have a section that says, what does it say there? It asks who the...
What does the text say?
Yeah, what does the text say? Sorry. Just pulling it up on the computer. Yeah, it says, what does the text say? Make a list of 15 observations of the passage. So just write down observations you have of the passage. So under number 1 and 2, also you'll see, what is the story? Who are the characters? What is the storyline? So I'll give you some time to read the passage, start making notes of things. About 5-10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, do you guys want a couple more minutes? Okay. 1 minute. Maybe talk about it. We'll have some more time to also continue looking and doing observations. Let's have 1 more minute and then we'll discuss. Okay, good. Let's talk about some of the observations we made, some things we noticed in the passage. What are some things you guys noticed in the passage? Some repeated phrases, some of the plot, like what's taking place here. Just any observations you made. Anyone want to share?
God tells them where to encamp.
Tells them where to encamp?
Not the word to go, yeah.
Mm. Yeah.
In terms of the main characters, God, Moses, Pharaoh, the people of Israel, the Egyptians, right at the beginning, God is speaking, God is sovereign.
Yeah, right at the very beginning. Right, so you have the characters there, and you have God speaking.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
It starts with him, yeah. God is speaking.
You have repetition of the Lord speaking. Verse 1, and the Lord spoke to Moses.
Yes.
Verse 15, the Lord said to Moses. Verse 26, I say again, the Lord said to Moses. I'm probably missing some there too. So you have a repetition, the Lord speaks, the Lord speaks, the Lord speaks. Do you notice the questions the people ask? You notice in verse 5, an event happens, there's a change, and then a question takes place in the Egyptians. They hear what happens. The king of Egypt is told that the people have fled. Then there's a change. The mind of the Pharaoh and his servants has changed.
Yes.
And then they ask a question. What is this we've done? But then in verse 10, something happens. The Egyptians are coming. There's a change in the Israelites. They fear. And then they ask three questions. Why did you bring us to the wilderness? You want to kill us? Didn't we say it was better in Egypt?
No, there's Egypt.
So just an observation. An event happens, there's a change in both the Egyptians, then a question. Verse 5 and in 10. Any other observations you have?
But in verse 11, you start accusing Moses and blaming him for taking them out of Egypt.
Yeah. So in verse 11, they question and accuse and blame Moses.
Actually, like they speaking about the dissatisfaction about him taking them out of their comfort zone and bringing them into a place where there's no comfort for them.
Yeah, they're uncomfortable and they're blaming Moses. He's brought them into this terrible place. So they're blaming him. Good. It's a good observation. And see, at this point, we're not yet saying, what does that mean? We're just saying, what does it say? Saying, this is what happened. We're just looking at the details. Just after this, we're going to ask, what does this mean? And that's where we get to the preaching, the teaching, everything else. Yes?
Another observation is verse 4 and 18, where God says that I will get my glory of Pharaoh, and also the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord.
Yes. There's a repetition in 4 and in verse 18, if I will get glory over Pharaoh, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. First, when I have gotten glory over Pharaoh. Yeah, there's the repetition in 4 and 18. 17 and 18. 4, it says, I will harden the heart of Pharaoh. I will get glory, and the Egyptians shall know. Verse 17, I will harden the heart of the Egyptians. I will get glory, and the Egyptians, 18, shall know that I am the Lord, when I have gotten glory. Yeah, so you see this repetition.
Verse
8? Yeah, verse 8, exactly. So there's three repetitions of I will harden the heart, and two repetitions where it specifically says, I will get glory that the Egyptians may know.
Verse 21 and 27, God tells Moses what to do, stretch out his hand, and then he stretches out his hand. Verse 27.
Yeah, in 21 and 26. And 26, he says, stretch out your hand over the sea, and then God acts when he stretches out his hand.
Was that the shift?
It seems like there's a pretty big shift happening there, that now God is acting. God is acting. The sea is opening up. But there's also, there's a couple different shifts, if you will. In verse 5, the Egyptians are just kind of sitting back in Egypt, and they hear, hey, this is happening. Then their hearts have changed. Then they go after them. Then the Israelites are just kind of hanging out there, camping. Then they see the people, and they fear. There's almost another shift. And then there's this response by God. So it's this climax of this building of events happening. First, the Egyptians hear, they go. Then the Israelites see the Egyptians, and they fear. They start questioning. They're freaking out. And then God acts. And that's where the real climax comes in. God is acting. In verse... in many places. He first speaks, and then he protects. Did you notice that in verse 19? Where is it? Sorry, let me look in my Bible. 19 to 20. He protects them. He comes with a cloud between him and the Egyptians, and he protects them. And then he divides the sea.
But then there's, you could use it as a conclusion where God is actually showing them in verse 30.
Yes.
Where the Israelites saw, now they see another wonder of God. In 31, they saw that.
Yes, in 30 and 31, you have a conclusion. Thus, the Lord saved Israel at that. So you have the action of God, he saved Israel. They saw the Egyptians dead. In 31, Israel saw the great power that the Lord used against the Egyptians. So, you have a result. The people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord. And in Moses, his servant. So after all this, you have a conclusion. The people they saw, and they fear, and they believe.
But what I want to witness here is that Moses was very silent. It was only the people that was talking. Not saying Moses was. It seems to me that Moses trusts God. He only, with a word, stretches out hands to God. Is it because of the speaking problem?
Well, maybe that's an interpretation question. But you do see, he says a very key thing here. As the people are complaining, Moses, like almost the central point of this passage in many ways, Moses speaks. And Moses said to the people, verse 13, "Fear not, stand firm, and see the salvation which the Lord has worked for you today. For the Egyptians you see today, you shall never see again. The Lord," verse 14, "the Lord will fight for you. You have only to be silent."
Yes.
He speaks what needs to be said.
Yes. Yeah. I think he only responded when God spoke to him. Yeah,
he's in obedience, yeah.
And after that, the Lord asked him, "Why do you cry to me?"
Yeah.
After he told the people, "Go tell the people, go forward." He first told them, and then the Lord said, "Why do you cry to me?"
Yeah, the people don't yet know at this point how the Lord's going to save them. Moses says, "Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord." In their eyes, they see, we either drown in the sea or we get brutally murdered by these Egyptians. There's no other way out. Actually, Patrick, and then we'll go back.
One of the significant observations for me is in verse 7, and the figure is 600. To me, the complete arsenal or the military might of the Egyptians is drawn into this fight in terms of verse 14. And then if you follow it up at verse 26 and 27, you find a complete annihilation. So there's a prayer planned by God almost, I know the interpretation now, to draw the whole army in and wipe them all out. Yeah. 600, the whole arsenal is there.
So you said in verse 7, you see the 600 chariots.
Yeah.
And then in what verse?
In verse 26 and 27, it's total annihilation.
26. The watermen come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots. In 27.
No one remained.
Israel was like an option.
Yeah, no one remained. Where do you see no one remained? Oh, in verse 28.
Verse 28,
yeah. All the hosts of Pharaoh that followed them into the sea, not one of them remained.
That's when the Lord fights the enemy.
The Lord fights the enemy for them. You have this great army, almost this world superpower coming after these enslaved people.
And the Lord hardened their hearts that they didn't even realize that they were running through the See, after the Israelites, because the heart was hardened, that
the hearts were so stubborn and hard.
They realized it was too late. Israel was like cheese in a mouse trap.
Yeah, they should have been able to see it. There was an observation over there.
In verse 14, it says that this is where God is giving assurance. And it says, the Lord will fight for you, and you only have to be silent. Then in verse 25, the clogging of their chariot wheels that drove heavily, and the Egyptians said, let us flee before Israel, for the Lord fights for them.
Yeah, the Egyptians actually saw the Lord's fighting for them.
Yes.
The covenant God of Israel, the one who sent the 10 plagues, he's fighting for them now.
It was too late.
Uh-oh, we're in trouble. That's a very good observation. So you see what we're doing here? We're just looking at the text. We're saying, what does it say? What is in the text here? Who's at play? What's the changes in the story? What's the climax of the story? How does it come to its climax? How does it come to its resolution? It comes to its resolution as the Lord destroys the armies of Egypt. It's interesting, you also see that as, let me see over here. The Lord said in 26, stretch out your hand that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots. So he stretched out his hand, and the 28, the waters returned and covered the chariots and all the hosts of Egypt that followed them into the sea. 29, but the people of Israel walked on dry ground through the sea. So you see this contrast between the people of the Israelites, or the Egyptians being destroyed in the water, and the Israelites being protected. They're walking on dry ground. And they're looking behind them and it's not a good day if you're an Egyptian in the Red Sea. Good. So every time we come to preach, sorry, Patrick, one last.
This is one. I mentioned from one of the observations in verse 19. For me, it's very significant there. The angel of the Lord appearing there and going before the Israelites. Now, there's some biblical scholars that believe that is Jesus. I don't know what. Maybe you can provide some insight on that or your interpretation.
Yeah, the angel of the Lord. I think we have to get back to that, because again, that's getting interpretive.
Okay.
That's important. We saw the angel of the Lord appear to Moses in the burning bush, but the angel of the Lord was actually God himself. So yeah, that's a theological question, is often this angel of the Lord figure appears, and there's something very unique about them. Many people say this is a pre-incarnate glory of Christ, is the angel of the Lord. So yeah, but again, that's a theological interpretive question. So every time we go to preach, we want to sit down first and think over the passage, ponder it, get into it, and start making observations. If you can print out a passage like this, just so you can write on it, scribble it, highlight it, because I don't necessarily want to do this to my Bible, because then next time you go to read it, you're like, ooh, hey, what's going on here? But it's nice if you can print it out, because then you can just go crazy on it. And then start writing out these observations, because it's going to help you when you come to preach it. And question number 3 on your packet. I guess we didn't get into question number 2, but those are things like we've talked about, that who the characters are, Israelites, Egyptians, God, Pharaoh. It's not really a character in the story, but the Red Sea almost is acting as this character that destroys the people. Very significant thing in the story.
Sorry, and Hunter, just only question 2, I know you're going to skip that.
Yeah.
But I know that one of the brothers here, I think, mentioned the issue of the chariot wheels. It's interesting that God does that, because he doesn't want him to flee back.
Yeah.
So he's already predetermined, you're going to get stuck there, out there, but you're not going to be able to return and go back. And that's why the wheels were clogged.
Yeah, that's very interesting. They get stuck. We don't know if that's because it was just muddy in the bottom or what, but something happened and they weren't able to get out.
They weren't able to be back there.
On number 2, think about why. Why did this happen? Is there anywhere in the passage where it specifically says why this took place? We spoke about it. Verse 4. And what was the other verse? 18? I will harden the heart of Pharaoh, and he will pursue them, and I will get glory over Pharaoh and all his hosts, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord. So that God may receive the glory. That God may receive the glory, that the Egyptians shall know. You see it also in verse 17 and 18. I will get glory, and the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, and I have gotten glory. And then in the very end, you have this conclusion that the people saw, the Israelites saw in 31, and they saw the great power of the Lord, and they feared. So this happened so that the people of Israel could see and fear and believe in the Lord, and this happened so that the Egyptians could know that the Lord is the true and the living God. Okay, so we're gonna pass on from question two. Question three, I'll just quickly help you with that. That's looking, at this point, we would look at the stories that surround it, but we're a bit short on time, so I can just explain. Right before this, in like chapter 13, 17 to 22, you see that God leads his people by a pillar of cloud, a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. So you see that already the Lord, as he's leading them out of Egypt, the Passover has just happened, the death of the firstborn in Egypt happened, and he saves his people through the blood of the Passover lamb. And now in 13, the end of 13, he's leading his people. So God's leading his people. Then this happens. God rescues his people from the final attack of the Egyptians. And then right after it, in the whole of chapter 15, you get the first song. It's the song of Moses. It's this celebration and this song of praise. Thank you, God, for saving us. Wow, you work salvation for us by your great and your mighty hand. And chapter 15 is this great song of salvation. Thank you, God. And then right after that, in the end of chapter 15, you have the people start grumbling in 15:22. And the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried to the Lord, and he showed him a log, and he threw it into the water, and it became sweet. And so after this, you start getting this series of stories where the people are complaining, they're whining, they're ungrateful. They've just seen the most amazing act of God's deliverance. And they're complaining. They don't get on their knees and say, "Lord, will you please provide for us? We're going through a hard time. We need you to intervene." No, they start complaining. "Oh, God, why did you bring us here?" And you just see story after story all the way, 15, the end of 15 through 17. The people are just complaining. And so amidst the salvation of God, even amidst the faithlessness of God's people, God is faithful. And you see it right in our passage. As the people are complaining, "Why did you bring us here to kill us? We wish we were back enslaved and being beaten and abused and brutally tortured by these Egyptians. That would have been better for us." They're complaining. And yet Moses promises salvation. "Fear not. Stand firm and see the salvation of the Lord." You don't even have to say anything. Be silent. Be silent and God will act. Amidst their faithfulness, God is faithful. So you see how it's fitting into those stories surrounding it. God's leading his people, God's protecting his people, God's saving his people, and his people are faithless. And we talked in question number four, how this fits into the whole story of Exodus. You'll see that big poster I gave you. That's from the Bible Project. I sent out an email, and in that email there's some links to a couple of videos specifically over that poster. And that'll give you a nice big overview. So when you're preaching your passage, you can think, "Hey, here's the big story. Let me tell you the big story of this passage and how it fits into the whole story." Number five is, what is the historical background? I gave you another handout. The one with the reading on it, on the historical background. This is from a study Bible. At this point, we want to look outside of the text and look at what are some other resources we can use to help us as we study the text, beyond just our own observation of the passage. So this is study notes from the ESV study Bible. On the second page where it says 14, crossing the Red Sea. Do you see that? On the top of the page, it says 167, Exodus 14. I want you to see those study notes just at the very bottom. I want you to go through and just read some of those study notes. And I'll give you a couple minutes to read those, and then we'll talk about it. Okay, were you able to read those notes? Okay, any observations you made of things they said which you thought were significant? So under number 5, you might write down some notes from here, or you just highlight and underline this and you use this in your historical background. Anything that stood out to you in that? Yes.
For me, the Egyptians having chariots, saying that at the time that was like a significant advantage when it comes to warfare.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. On the note under 14, verse 7, it says, the possession of chariots represented a significant advantage in ancient Near Eastern warfare. So this is like the most high-tech military equipment that they're coming out against the Egyptians with, or the Israelites with.
The tank.
Or like the stealth bomber jet or something. Yeah. Or like the drone coming after these people with very advanced technology. Yeah, it's significant.
When the 14:10 says when Israel saw the Egyptians, the great fear, they had a great fear. That's
It's a theme that they feared greatly in the section that greatly is significant. And right after that, it's interesting. It says, through the plagues, and counting on their journey to Sinai, Yahweh calls Israel to fear him over any other nation or battlefield.
Yes, but they fear the Lord.
So they're supposed to have a greater fear for the Lord than they have for the nations. Other observations?
The question the Egyptians asked.
Yeah.
What is this that we have done? The Israelites asking Moses, what is this that you have done to us? Let us now die in the wilderness.
So there's this repetition of the questions, It says that the Egyptians' question, the Israelites' question resembles that of the Egyptians' question, and they wrongly attribute their circumstance to Moses. It's under 14, verse 5. Yeah, so there's two similar questions, and kind of we had noticed that in as we were doing our observations. Anything else?
Yes, they are viewing their circumstances without reference to the fact that the Lord himself brought them to this place. They looking at the situation, but they do not see God for who he is.
Yeah.
That God actually brought them there and he was able to take them out of Egypt. So would he not protect them there?
Yeah, I thought that was significant. It says they're viewing their circumstance without reference to the fact that the Lord himself brought them to this place. It's like they suddenly forgot the 10 plagues on Egypt. They suddenly forgot the Passover. They forgot what God had done. Jonathan?
Yeah, it's interesting to see that they were more prepared to serve the Egyptians than to serve the God of all the miracles that have taken place so far.
Yeah, and in the passage they're actually like, we would have rather been back serving the Egyptians. The pagan Egyptians that were enslaving them and beating them and murdering all their baby boys. We wish we were serving them again. Those guys are great.
Yeah, they were born as slaves. They didn't need anything else.
Yeah, it's almost like they just have this...
They want to stay there wherever they...
Yeah. Patrick?
One significant interpretation for me is in the 14th verse. Is who's fighting and what's our role? God is in the fight, and he says, watch me fight, and you just be silent. It's again, interpreting it for me today is, you know, sometimes we have a self-strategy to fight the enemy within us or without us. But God says, be silent, let me fight for you. And his strategy is the one that we should be looking at,
In verse 14, so you're back to that observation. The action and role of God is the one who fights, and the people, just be quiet.
Be quiet.
So do you see the action of God, the action of man? Good. Under six, that's, we're not necessarily going to do that right now. Well, we can do that quickly. Number six, write a summary of what this passage meant to the original audience. What would this story have meant to the Israelites first hearing it who were wandering in the wilderness? It would be a reminder of that God is the God who saves. As the Israelites are facing their hardships, they're facing trials, they're facing circumstances that are difficult, it reminds the Israelites that God is the one who saves them. That God is the one who protects them as he protected them from the Egyptians. That God is the one who's sovereign over nature. He's the one who pushed back the sea so they could walk through. So in this step, we're saying not what does this mean to me, but what did this mean to them? Because as we understand what this meant to them, we can then understand now how does this apply to my life. You see, because you're kind of getting in their shoes and you're getting in their culture and saying, okay, we're not these Egyptians wandering in the wilderness. We're not these Israelites wandering in the wilderness. So what did this mean to them? And now we begin to think, what does this mean to us? Okay? What other thoughts on what this meant to the original Israelites wandering in the wilderness? Any other thoughts, or is that pretty accurate? This shows the salvation of God. The Lord is the one who saves.
Yes.
Okay, so that whole section was step one of the process. What does this mean in the original audience's context? What does this mean in the biblical audience's culture and context? We've been spending all this time just in the text. And you'd spend even, as you're preparing your sermon, you'd spend even more time in a study Bible, reading the background notes, reading as much as you can, reading Bible dictionaries. Things we'll actually be giving some Bible dictionaries and handbooks out later. Things that you can actually use to study. You'd spend time in these resources to see, what does this mean? What does this mean? You're thinking over it. You're meditating on the Word of God. What does this mean to the original people?